In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
You might remember that in 2016, a conservative political outsider got elected, who, once he was sworn in, actually started to work on fulfilling his campaign promises. But doing that got him in trouble with the other political party, and even with people in his own party. And the so-called justice system got involved and started an investigation relying on lies and falsified evidence. Except who you're thinking about probably isn't the person I'm talking about. But we'll come back around to that. This week, you're going to hear exactly why it is so important to elect the right people. And not just at the top of the ticket, but all the way down to the bottom. Mayors, city councilors, people like judges and district attorneys. We all know that presidents and governors get to appoint hundreds of people to positions of authority. And that's critical because those are the people making sure that the elected leader's vision gets accomplished. But there are people under those appointed that can and will cause a lot of damage, the bureaucrats. A good leader needs to appoint other good leaders who will ensure that everyone is on the same page and not trying to gum up the works. We've seen for years, well over a decade, the abuse at the Justice Department and the FBI. The FBI has and will continue to try to set people up, entrap them. And if that doesn't work, they'll go after you for lying, by hoping to trip you up as you try to explain the truth of what really happened. This is the weaponization of law enforcement, because the law doesn't matter. It's who is enforcing the law. Because if you don't do a crime, the FBI, the DIJ, or, as you'll hear on today's show, elected district attorney prosecutors will invent a crime. And then good luck trying to prove something didn't happen when they control the evidence, when they control the rules, and when they have unlimited government funds to drag things out as they drag you through the mud. That's not America, and it's time people are held accountable by removing them from office. You've heard the expression that elections have consequences. Well, I hope today's show convinces you of that more than ever. Kimberly Herman is the general counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation. They fight for your rights and defend the Constitution. They are also the attorney for John Solomon's organization, Just the News, and they just had a big Freedom of Information win on John's behalf to get records from a Missouri prosecutor in a very strange case that forced a sitting governor out of office. Kimberly, welcome back. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you guys.
Yeah, so we'll get to your lawsuit for John Solomon in just a bit, but let's get some background because this is a really strange case and one that I think that just never really got the attention it deserved, perhaps because it was so weird. It sounded like a conspiracy theory and almost too unbelievable. Kimberly Garden, a Soros-connected anti-police prosecutor in Missouri, went after the sitting governor, recently elected in 2016, Eric Greitens, and he was a political outsider, pro-police, and was out there fulfilling his campaign promises to cut back on lobbyists and stop millions of public funding going to the well-connected. And her prosecution then helped to force him to step down, except it was all made up. She never had the evidence that she claimed, and a former FBI got involved too, was helping to manufacture evidence and whatnot. So can you help fill in the backstory for us and any details that I'm missing?
Yeah, I mean, there were some allegations that she brought, and she eventually brought charges against against Eric Greitens, mm-hmm. For improper conduct, right, for misconduct with a female. And the evidence that this was all based off of, at the end of the day, ended up being fabricated. We learned that recently. She used an outside investigator who, if I recall, had maybe been a former FBI agent or was an FBI agent,
yes.
Basically was not in the line, regardless, this person was not in the line of prosecutorial investigation, should not have been involved in this case from the beginning. And so we had, false evidence false allegations. And like you said, it ended up blowing up really a man's life and his career at the time, to the point where he stepped down from being governor of Missouri.
Yeah, that investigator was a former FBI agent who, ironically enough, was fired from the FBI for lying. And so a lot of this is just, as I said, it just seemed almost too unbelievable to be true. It's no great secret that politicians or anyone else has affairs. And the only reason I could see that she would go after him was because he was on the opposite side of the political aisle. Was there some other reason that she had targeted him, or that there was allegations that he was somehow corrupt above and beyond the affair?
No, I mean, based on the knowledge that I have, it's solely based on what you said. He's on the other side of the aisle. And, you know, when you look at Kim Gardner, she is one of our country's Soros-backed prosecutors, mm-hmm. right? So George mm-hmm. Soros and his affiliates and companies went around the country like they do and put a tremendous amount of money into the campaigns of these local prosecutors because they actually have tremendous amounts of power. People just don't realize how much power their local prosecutors have. And it was for the sole purpose of getting them in place so that they could essentially go after politicals, right? Go after candidates, go after politicians that the Soros, you know, backed engine wanted out of office. And here they succeeded. But, you know, this is something that we've been working to expose, and that John Solomon and Just the News, as you mentioned, has also been working to expose over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. There was a really interesting interview between John Solomon and Eric Greitens, the governor that was forced to step down. And Gardner dropped the case, apparently, when the judge ordered her, Gardner, would have to testify. Now, that's not at all telling, but how often does that happen, that a judge orders the prosecutor to testify under oath?
I would imagine not often enough, based on what we've been learning over the last few years, right, with corruption in this really? Office, and with the FBI and the federal agencies also. But, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at her track record, you know, she's got complaint after complaint mm-hmm. after complaint against her. She is going to be held accountable. And, you know, this goes back to attorney misconduct also, right? Look at Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Right. We had a sitting right. president who lied under oath, and it took my organization, actually, Southeastern Legal Foundation, to file a bar complaint against her, take it all the way up to the Arkansas Supreme Court, and get his bar license revoked. Yeah. Right. The only lasting punishment he had from that whole scandal was that he could no longer practice law. And so it's just so important for the profession that when there is misconduct, attorneys are held accountable.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll have more with Kimberly Herman talking about the strange case there in Missouri. They just had a big win on public records. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking with Kimberly Herman. She's the general counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation. And back in 2018, a Soros-backed prosecutor in Missouri helped to force the elected governor, Eric Greitens, a conservative outsider, to step down. That case was later dropped when the judge ordered that the prosecutor would have to testify. And so Kim, you guys just had a big win here. You have been pursuing some public records here. You had initially filed, I think, in July of 2019, for 2.5 years worth of communications between Gardner, that's the prosecutor, and the Missouri Workforce Housing Association, State Representative Stacey Newsom and Jay Barnes, along with several other groups and individuals, one of which was George Soros. So Soros, I get in terms of trying to, you know, get access to those communications. But why those other people and groups?
Well, you know, what we were just talking about with Eric Greitens, and you asked, you know, why did this even happen, right? Why was he then being investigated if they had to actually fabricate evidence? Well, we want to know the answer to that, too. Because when you have DAs and you have prosecutors and attorneys who are engaging in misconduct, they don't only need to be held accountable, but we need to know where it's coming from. And I highly doubt that Kim Gardner created this entire thing on her own. Hmm. And so really trying to understand the communications that she had with these people, and we believe that those communications will tell the rest of the story.
So are you suspicious anyway that this may be systemic inside the government?
Unfortunately, yeah. You know, it's not just at this level. I mean, what we've learned from you know, the Russia hoax, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. and from the, you know, sham impeachments. And, you know, what's coming out with Durham's investigation is exactly what we thought we'd see there, is that we just have, you know, attorney after attorney in the government kind of being, you know, used really to engage in this level of misconduct. Mm. And it's a problem in the profession, honestly, that needs to kind of be rooted out. And especially when it comes to, you know, undermining our government, yeah. and undermining our confidence in our institutions.
Oh, absolutely. Trust and confidence and all the rest. I mean, it's just astonishing to think that this sort of thing happens in America. I mean, this is what you used to see in the Soviet Union, where the law was used to go after people that were just outside of the political favor. And it's just insane that this is happening here. Your case, seeking these public records, it's been going on for a few years now. You won disclosure in early 2020, I believe. She initially ignored it, then claimed that the documents did not fall under the state sunshine law. She lost that, continued to fight and appealed it all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court, which refused to hear her appeal, and she was ordered to produce the requested records within 30 days. So will she? And what would happen if she doesn't?
Yeah, if she doesn't, we're going to have to go back to the court again. Right now, we're about, I forget if it's 15, 16 days. We're a little over 2 weeks into the Supreme Court rejecting her last futile attempt at an appeal. And all I know is that whatever is in these documents, they clearly don't want to give us. It's been, like you said, almost 3 years that we've been fighting for them. The court ruled early on that our client, John Solomon, was entitled to these documents. And now we're just going to have to continue to pursue them. And, you know, we've litigated FOIA cases that have taken 7 years, unfortunately. We've eventually gotten the documents.
Wow.
But it's unbelievable the lengths that those in the government will go to hide public records. These are records that belong to the public, not to these individuals.
I'm astounded that they can take 7 years. So I guess looking at this particular case, one has to wonder, why hide it? I mean, if it's all above board and everything's fair and honest and straightforward and legal, why would you bother to hide it? And also, are you afraid that she's pulled a Hillary here and just started destroying evidence?
I mean, if she has, luckily under Missouri law, there are penalties that will then be assessed against her and against anyone else who, if any documents end up being destroyed, or, you know, not available. And so, you know, that is one other thing under state sunshine law, laws that doesn't exist under the federal law, is that there are civil and monetary penalties that the court can enforce against them.
What kind of interference do you think that George Soros could be doing in terms of, like, let's just say, for example, that maybe he's telling her to do certain things. Could that lead to civil prosecution of him?
You know, that would just depend. You know, they're very smart in what they do, the progressive left, right?
Yes,
they've been doing this, whether you're talking at a I was talking earlier today to somebody about how they're doing this at a city level with school boards and with city councils and with mayors and stuff. People only think that it's there with, you know, Senate elections and the presidential election, but the progressive left is very smart. And it's why, frankly, it's why we as Americans have to pay attention and be involved.
Yep.
And get out and vote, even in the elections that seem super small. Educate yourself.
Well, absolutely. And of course, that's how they learn to do this, is they at the level that she was doing it. They're going after the governors because you get experience doing it at the city level. So the Supreme Court had also ordered that John Solomon be paid attorney's fees and costs for the appeal. Is there any sense of punitive damages for also who pays for those? Her personally or the taxpayers of Missouri?
Well, the FOIA request was against the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office. And so now that we're back down at the lower court, we'll see how the court wants to enforce that. So it will be up to the judge as to how he enforces that. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times this comes from the taxpayer dime,
yeah.
whether it's the time that they've spent on the appeal, a fruitless, futile appeal, or whether it's the, you know, penalties that come into play. But, you know, if individuals have done things wrong and broken the law, they will be held personally accountable, and we will make sure that they are.
Is that true there within Missouri? Because it's awfully hard to hold some of these public officials personally accountable. That's why they do what they do sometimes, is because they know that they can't personally be held responsible.
Yeah, there are some civil penalties that can be assessed against individuals. And so, again, because the judge hasn't ruled on that, I'm going to have to wait and kind of see how that ends up playing out in the court. So we are back down at the trial court, and we will be filing our motions for attorney's fees and penalties and things like that in the next coming days.
Good. So real quick, John Solomon has said that there is a lot to this story the public hasn't seen yet. Do you know what he's referring to there in terms of what we haven't seen?
A lot of it's going to be in these documents. So once we get the documents and we can verify some of the stories that we've heard and that we've been told, then I'm sure that John and Just the News is going to do a great job kind of getting them out to the public. But it's one thing I love about John and about Just the News is that they don't put stories out unless they can verify it 10 ways till Sunday. And so these documents are what's needed to do that and to get the job done.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with Kimberly Herman after this, talking about prosecutorial misconduct. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Kimberly Herman. She is the General Counsel for Southeastern Legal Foundation. And from their website, Southeastern Legal Foundation believes that the U.S. Constitution is a complete document creating limits on government. When the government goes beyond those limits, we hold the government accountable, enforce the Constitution, and rebuild the American Republic under the original design laid out by our founding fathers. Their website is slfliberty.org, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. And also, you can always contact them if you think that you've got a potential case that they may want to take on. So today we've been talking about prosecutorial misconduct and the odd case of a Soros-funded prosecutor going after the sitting governor of Missouri. And this is interesting. This is from the Missouri's chief legal disciplinary officer, who has accused Gardner, the prosecutor, of rampant misconduct in her prosecution of Greitens, saying that she lied to judges in court filings and testimony, withheld exculpatory evidence from the defense, misled her own prosecution team, and violated the constitutional right to a fair trial. In a 73-page memo, they allege that she engaged in 62 acts of misconduct and resulted in 79 false representations during her prosecution of Greitens. That's pretty astounding to hear that much misconduct. I'm surprised. Is there anything on the state level that they can do to remove this woman?
I would hope so. There has to be some level of procedure, and I honestly don't know the details of what you would do in Missouri when you have a DA that is engaged in misconduct. But I would imagine that, when you have this level of misconduct, there's going to be a bar investigation. And if her bar license is taken, then she certainly can't be in that position. So that's one way that she should be held accountable if all of these allegations are true, which there's enough of them out there, I think, to make some presumptions, and there's some assumptions. So I feel pretty confident that she will have some lasting punishments here, and hopefully will no longer be the DA, where she can, completely and utterly act in a way that you're ruining people's lives.
Yeah. Well, right? So far, I know that she's scheduled to face a disciplinary hearing. I haven't seen exactly the outcome of that, if that's happened yet. But so far, nothing has happened to her. After her false prosecution, not only did she not get removed from office, she was flipping reelected in 2020. I mean, that's just astounding that somebody can be this corrupt and yet somehow manage to get reelected.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you just have to look at the electorate, and are they educating themselves, right? Are we getting the information to them? Podcasts like this are great because we can help get the information out to the American public. And so it's such a great service, that you're doing here. But, it like I said earlier, it's just a constant reminder that Americans need to educate themselves.
Yes.
I mean, we almost ended up with Hillary Clinton. Think about that as our president, with all of the misconduct that she's engaged in.
Well, it's not just paying attention to the big races either. It's these smaller down ballot races like this prosecutor that everybody needs to pay attention to. We're in an age where prosecutors can charge someone with no evidence, and they will lie about it or try to invent it. And, it's not fiction anymore. This isn't something that's happening in movies. They have done this against a sitting president, and a sitting governor. And what's terrifying here is that those two had the financial resources to at least be able to defend themselves. Good luck to the average non-millionaire to try to fight the bottomless resources of the government, because they can bleed you dry until you run out of funds and are forced to submit. So what do we need to do about this on a systemic level?
I mean, first of all, we need to hold, like you said, hold these people accountable. But one thing that I find really interesting when you look at all of this, and then I hate admitting this as an attorney, but the problems really do tend to stem from the attorneys that are involved. I mean, look at everything with what we know for sure now with absolute positivity, you know, that everything with Russia and the Steele dossier that, you know, is what led to everything to investigate Trump and illegally spy on his campaign. At the center of all of that was a law firm that they used.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what type of relationships are these politicians, to be perfectly honest, having with these law firms? And are they fronts? You know, at the end of the day, are these law firms being fronts to just be political activists behind the scenes and create false stories?
Yeah.
We need to question that. And as a profession, we need to be paying very close attention to this, because it's going to undermine what we all do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned the fake Russia collusion. We know for a fact that that was fake because of John Brennan's handwritten notes there at the White House meeting, that they knew that Hillary was planning on painting Trump with Russia collusion. So everything that followed from that point, as far as the intelligence agencies, we knew that that was all false, because they all knew that it was nothing more than a political stunt. I mean, that's astonishing.
Yeah.
When you think that they were willing to sacrifice the entire integrity of the intelligence communities to go after a political opponent. But even aside from that, what we're really seeing is the weaponization of law enforcement. And this isn't prosecutorial overreach, where it's some prosecutor trying to make a name for themselves or being overly zealous. This is outright fraud. This is prosecutors not just planting evidence, it's prosecutors inventing evidence that they then plant. I mean, how do we stop that?
Yeah, I mean, by holding these people accountable. I mean, really, that's the best way in finding out where the root cause is. You know, unfortunately, we're going to continue to have people that are trying to be bad actors, right? I mean, if we can solve that, I mean, we'll just solve all the world's problems. But, you know, there are mechanisms, like we've been talking about, for holding. There's disciplinary councils. There's, you know, I believe that in the Durham investigation, jumping, you know, back to kind of the Russia collusion and the misconduct there, I believe we're going to see some people truly held accountable there. I mean, it means jail time. And it should. And we need to go back and revisit how we're really the level of authority that we're giving to these prosecutors also.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you, is do we need to make it easier to prosecute prosecutors?
Yeah, I mean, they're people just like everyone else, right? Yeah. And so when they act in a bad way, when they act illegally and they violate the law, they should be held accountable, just like every single other person in this country would be. They're not above the law. There are just, unfortunately, some bad actors who think they are. Now, for every bad actor, there's going to be 10 or 100 good actors, right? And so, you know, that also needs to be made. There's people that are in those roles for the right reasons, and they are putting the bad guys behind bars. Some of them want to put the bad guys behind bars, and we've got the Biden administration not letting them, right? You know, so it's certainly not everyone, but the bad actors need to be held accountable.
Oh, absolutely. And we also need people within those agencies to start standing up. As I said, everybody that was involved in the intelligence community, you know, they were acting in bad faith, and we didn't have enough people within those intelligence communities to stand up and put a stop to it, because they should have known better when they started to see the lack of evidence. Unfortunately, Kim, we're up against the time. I want to thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd like to welcome Bridget Barton to the show. She is a conservative writer and businesswoman who for over 30 years has advocated for conservative solutions to Oregon's problems. She is also a Republican candidate for Oregon's governor. Bridget, it's great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, you're a writer and a businesswoman. So tell us about the magazine that you had started back in the late 90s, Brainstorm Northwest. What led you to start that, and what solutions to problems were you advocating?
Well, this is a good lead into why I'm running for governor. Because actually, even back in 1997, some of the more prominent private business owners, big private companies around the state, were starting to notice that the powers that be in government were taking on a very anti-business attitude. And they felt that they didn't have a voice. Because if you think back to 97, this was before Fox News. This was before Lars had his show really going on air. There was really no conservative media in the state. And it was at this point, actually, that media started to kind of split between being conservative or liberal. And the only thing out there really was the Oregonian. And that was beginning to take this kind of negative attitude towards business and natural resources in particular. So a lot of these private business owners around the state came together and decided they would support our pro-business, pro-conservative ideas magazine, just so that there could be at least one voice in the state that was advocating a positive business climate, a positive economic growth climate, and kind of looking out for rural Oregon and blue-collar Oregon, too. And it turns out that they were very prescient in their views. They were correct. Things were turning. So yeah. We had that business, and the magazine was around from 1997 till just after the recession, at which point we took it just virtual online as a newsletter. And, it was an important voice in the state to get ideas and solutions out there.
So that was in the late 90s when Republicans really started to lose ground across the state. And I'm guessing the powers that were didn't exactly listen to you the way that they ought to have, considering the slide that we had. So what was the reception like to your solutions then versus how those same kind of solutions are received today?
I think you can easily look back and see that the Democrats began to take more and more control over state government. We haven't had a Republican governor since the mid-80s, so it's been almost 40 years. And the reception we got then was warmer. It got icier and icier as time went along. But at the same time, my business partner and I we began to be looked to as the voice for conservative ideas. So because of that, I've had a lot of experience with media, being on TV, on radio, responding to press inquiries. You know, when anybody needed to get the conservative voice, they would often call our office and say, do you have a comment? Or, you know, what do you think about this policy coming through? And, we maintain sort of that position. But as you well know, the Democrats have taken a stronger and stronger grip over state government over the years. And in the last 10 years, the public has started to see the results of this. It's been like a snowball rolling downhill, gaining momentum in the last 10 years. And the very progressive left wing of the Democrat Party has almost taken this state off a cliff.
Yes.
To the point where regular people they say, what happened to the state?
Yeah.
You know, and they're so frustrated about what they options they can do to fix things. And they're, you know, in rural Oregon, it's to the level of outright anger. There's no other way to describe it.
Yeah.
It's outright anger.
Yeah.
We're getting that even now in the urban areas over certain issues like the schools and the homeless crisis and the rising crime rate. There is growing anger, and it's cross-partisan divide. These are not partisan issues.
Well, what I have liked,
everyone.
Yeah, what I have liked to see too is that people are finally starting to wake up that this isn't just a problem out there. This is a problem caused by the people that are in office right now. I think that's a real opportunity for Republicans this time around.
It absolutely is. There is no other way to see it if you have your eyes open than to realize that we've had the same party in power for 40 years and at every level of the state, the higher state offices. So they really are in a very bad position this cycle, to put it mildly. And while there is going to be a national red wave, here in Oregon, it's more about these very sort of kitchen table, ground level issues that it isn't even about red or blue or Democrat or Republican. They have woken up and realized whoever's running this state, and it happens to be the Democrats, they are doing a terrible job. So I'm coming in as an outsider and saying I'm the problem solver, and I am going to hold Tina Kotek and Betsy Johnson, both Democrats, I'm going to hold them accountable for the mess they've made of this state, period. We are not going to get distracted onto partisan issues. We're going to talk about the mess they've made of this state and hold them accountable. I will come in and put a hard stop to those policies and begin to turn the state around on some of these very core problem issues that affect everybody.
Yes,
they affect everyone.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you talk about a red wave there, and I think that's possible. But, of course, Oregon tends to be different sometimes. It's one thing to say, oh, gosh, these Democrats are doing a horrible job. It's another thing to actually vote against Democrats and vote them out of office. So what do you think it will take for Oregonians to pull the trigger for Republicans?
Well, I look back to, you know, speaking of the red wave, you look back to the last time we had one, which was the year that Chris Dudley ran, and he lost by only 22,000 votes in a two-way kind of standard Republican-Democrat race. The issues on the table were similar, but they weren't nearly as bad as they are now, not even close. And so that was 2010. And come forward another 12 years, and the damage done by the liberals, the left in power, is so much more significant. And we add to that it will be a three-way race. So the Republican that is nominated, I think I would be the best possible nominee because I am a conservative Republican. I'm wanting to solve these issues. And I'm wanting to deal with the problems that the actual people out there in Oregon are having to deal with every day. But I will be able, as I said, to hold the left accountable for the mess. So they are going to have to fight over the Democrat votes,
right,
between Betsy Johnson and Tina Kotek.
And as long as Republicans stay solid and don't
hold
desert
together
and don't defect to Betsy Johnson, because, oh, at least she's not as bad as Tina Kotek, I think Republicans can win. All right, everyone, take a break. Coming up, we talk about the solutions to Oregon's problems. We're talking with Bridget Barton. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today with Bridget Barton. She is a businesswoman and a conservative writer who's been focused on conservative solutions to the problems here in Oregon. She's also a Republican candidate for governor. And, you know, we're talking about the possibility of a red wave there. And I have always been political, and you know, I had an interest in politics going way back to elementary school days, although I did not become actively involved with the party until 2009. And aside from Reagan, I have always thought Republicans have had a terrible time with the communication end of things, communicating their message on issues, communicating their ideas and solutions. So why do you think that Republicans tend to be so terrible on the communication end?
Oh, I'm not 100% sure, but I can tell you one thing. When I was asked to join this race and asked to run for governor, one of the things that the sort of this network of people that came to me said is, you have experience with the media and in communications. And oftentimes I think we fall back on the same old tired faces and people who they have legislative experience. But, you know, they've never actually done communication with the public. And the left is better at putting forward people that have, for lack of a better word, more polish on communication. So I think, again, it's an asset that I will bring. It's important, not just for campaigning. It's important, as we saw, for example, with Ronald Reagan. It's important to be able to have strong communication skills when you're in office.
Right, right,
and,
exactly.
I think it's one of Kate Brown's biggest failings, and I don't think it's an asset that Tina Kotek has.
She doesn't need to communicate. She just tells you what to do, and you're expected to do it. So
exactly.
Why bother to communicate? So, you mentioned, though, the issue of once you're in government and the importance of communications. And, you know, managing the state is a huge task because it's a huge organization with thousands of workers. You obviously haven't run the government before, but do you have a human resource experience managing large-scale organizations? Or asking that another way, what makes you confident that you could tackle the quagmire that is the government of the state of Oregon?
Oh, boy, and is it a quagmire? I do have background managing staffs, a fairly large staff in the past, and it's always been something I've enjoyed doing. I think my communication style, I'm very direct, very clear, very straightforward about establishing a vision. I'm good at delegating, and I think probably one of the most important skills that the governor needs to have is selecting a very strong team around them. And you know what? Not being afraid of hiring and you delegating to other very strong people. Mm. I like to surround myself with other strong people and build a really solid team. So going forward, you're right. It's going to, the best comparison, I hate to bring up the Trump word, but I will, is, you know, when he got into office, the assault on him throughout that 4 years was unrelenting.
Absolutely.
And just vicious, mm-hmm. vicious. Now, after 40 years of Democrat control, if a Republican takes office, they should expect to get a very strong backlash. And I expect it. I'll be ready for it. It's going to be part of the job to deal with it. And I think that my very clear, strong communication style is going to be helpful. The other thing that'll be helpful is I enjoy communicating with large groups of people. I enjoy traveling the state. Unlike our current governor, I will be a very visible governor. I will be out there with the media. I'm not afraid to be with them, to talk with them, even if they're adversarial. I'm ready to communicate my vision and my messages about where we're heading with the state across the whole state to all the media around the state. And I've been doing that throughout this campaign, too. I haven't turned down any interviews. Right. I enjoy doing them.
Well, I'd like to drill down a little bit on that, the notion of the importance of having a team and also the viciousness that you would face, because, you know, running your own magazine or anyone that's out there running their own business, pretty much the people that are there are all going to be on the same side with similar goals. You know, most workers are going to want the head of the organization to succeed. But stepping into the reins of the governor's office, you're obviously going to have a lot, if not most, of the people opposed to you. Your goals mm-hmm. and your politics and everything else. So how would you get people to work together to make your goals succeed? And maybe you have an example you could point to where you've done that in the past.
Well, I'll just go straight to the first answer, part of the answer first, which is to say, you know, I think you have to understand, I do understand what my position will be power-wise vis-a-vis the Democrats when I get into the office. So I have to know, be clearly aware of what my PowerPoints are. So what I have is the opportunity to appoint up to 300 people on boards, commissions, mm-hmm. and heads of agencies. And I also will have the power of the veto pen and the line item veto pen on spending bills. So those need to kind of be used together. And I also have the bully pulpit, which I'm, again, not afraid to use strongly, loudly, consistently. But those appointments are probably the key point, because I'll take the first one that I would do, and that is I would appoint a new deputy superintendent of public instruction. And that from that person, I would execute my vision, my policies, my idea for what the public school goals and potential should be. And for me, that is to rid the schools of any ideological agenda at all. Any sort of some of this stuff that's being pumped into the kids that has nothing to do with academics. My vision, my goal is academic excellence. So we'll bring back standards. And the person I hire at the top will be responsible for then delegating down and hiring people below them. And anyone in the Department of Education who isn't interested in being a part of that vision, that's fine, but then we'll need to find a new job.
Yeah, I was going to say
that's going to be the vision.
Yep, there's lots of other jobs out there. So, all right, let's go and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with Bridget Barton. Her website is bridgetbartonfororegon.com. That's fororegon.com. We'll link that up on ispireradio.com as well to make that easier to find. Stay with us.
Thank you.
back in our final segment now here on the I Spy Radio Show. We're talking with Bridget Barton. She's a businesswoman, writer, and conservative outsider running for Oregon's governor as a Republican. And her website, one more time, BridgetBartonForOregon.com, and the four is F-O-R. So, Bridget, what do you think sets you apart from other candidates? Why should voters choose you over someone else?
Well, again, I come in as an outsider, have no baggage, and so I don't owe anyone anything, so I can do anything. And it's also, in this particular cycle, this is important. I have no aspirations for a long-term political career. I'm 69 years old, so I have nothing to lose. And so I'm going to be, everything's going to be on the table. I'm really going to be able to push back hard. And I say, always out there on the campaign trail, I'm running to put a hard stop to our 40-year decline and really make some headway on these kitchen table issues. And, you know, one in particular that I have some unique expertise on is the homelessness issue, because I'm 40 years in recovery from alcoholism myself. And so, you know, I started drinking when I was 14. I stopped when I was 28, and I was very near homelessness myself. So when I go out and see these thousands of homeless people on the street, I understand from my core that what we're doing is not compassionate. It is enabling people to commit slow suicide on our streets right before our eyes. It is inhumane behavior. And our policy of housing first is an absolute total failure. And our elected officials have utterly failed to address this problem. So I have a very clear plan. I think we need to flip the model. We need to create a database so that law enforcement can clear our streets and put these people into low barrier shelters. And at that point, they need to go into treatment. But as you probably know, we're number two in the country in substance abuse per capita, but we are number 50 in treatment beds per capita. After spending billions of dollars, we have not created any treatment. So we have a substance abuse problem. We don't have a homeless problem or a housing problem. We have, it's a substance abuse problem. I also think an incredibly important component to solving this problem is the repeal of ballot measure 110, which I would try to organize in my first year in office by pulling together law enforcement, parents groups around the state that are horrified at these drugs that are coming in, and the treatment community, which also found measure 110 abhorrent. So those forces, if we bring them together, I think we can go to the voters and ask for a repeal of this measure. The law enforcement community says crime, substance abuse, homelessness, they are intertwined. And if that's the reason we have the soaring crime rate that we have, is the substance abuse problem, which creates the homeless problem. And if we don't repeal that measure and get to the bottom of this and get people into treatment, real treatment, the state is going down. That comes from the mouths of law enforcement across the state. So this is a very serious problem for the state. It's an intertwined problem. And of all the candidates, I have this unique expertise and experience to bring to bear on it. I've been on the board of DePaul Treatment Center in downtown Portland for years.
Yeah, I was going to say, you beat me to it, because that was one of the things I was going to ask you about, was you dealing with 40 years of recovery, because that is obviously going to give you a real insight into these kinds of issues. As far as the prescriptions that you've outlined here, have you seen those kinds of treatments and addressing these issues because of the addiction issues, have you seen those work in other cities or states?
Yes, of course. In fact, I just find it shocking that we haven't gotten to this point already, because if everybody travels to other states occasionally, and if you go to other states and communities, you come back and come back to Oregon, you think, why aren't we? Why can't we be like those other states?
Right.
Why aren't we like Idaho, or why aren't we like San Diego? Where you go to San Diego, well, San Francisco and LA might look like hell, but the city of San Diego has a different way of dealing with it. They get the people off the streets right away.
Well, see, that's the next question. Then is, why aren't we doing those things that clearly are working in other states?
Because we have 40 years of Democrats in power who don't seem to find any incentive to get this done. And I will say, I'm going to be more cynical than that and tell you this. We have created what I call the homeless industrial complex. There, all this billions of dollars in bonds and taxes that we've approved to help so-called help the homeless, the most recent one being Measure 110, this money all goes into new government jobs, new grants to new nonprofits, more and more money cycling into people that don't need help. They just want work and money. And anyone who's ever taken an economics class will tell you what we've created is a reverse incentive to solve the problem. If your job is homeless advocacy, you know, out of the state government somehow, if you solve the problem, you're out of a job. Well, I don't think it's quite as direct as that, but that is the truth. There is no incentive for these people to actually solve the problem. They just go out and keep recycling through the same people. Anybody who's been had anything to do with anyone with a substance abuse problem will tell you, you've got to slam a hard stop in front of those people over and over again to get to make any headway. And the last thing you would do is hand them keys to a house.
Yeah, and that's just insane. Bridget, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been really enlightening. Her website, one more time, is BridgetBarton4Oregon.com. That's FOR4Oregon.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page as well to make that easier to find. Bridget, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me a chance to talk to voters.
So after our interview with Kim Herman, I looked up what, if anything, had happened to the Missouri prosecutor because I knew that she had had a scheduled disciplinary hearing rescheduled. And I found this from Fox 2 Now. Gardner, quote, acknowledges that she made mistakes in her handling of the prosecution of former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, but won't face severe penalties for those mistakes. The joint stipulation agreement was announced just as a disciplinary hearing for Gardner was about to begin. It calls for no suspension, no probation, or disbarment. Unbelievable. 62 acts of misconduct that resulted in 79 false representations, and she gets off with a slap on the wrist. And that's the problem, isn't it? People inside the system are held to a lower standard when it should be a higher one. She's a flippin' attorney, a prosecutor. She knew what she was doing was wrong and did it anyway. The only way this gets fixed is removing the people who are elected and putting in new ones who will hold people, all people, accountable when they violate the law. Otherwise, we don't have laws, we don't have a justice system, we have a popularity system. Pay attention to how you vote and for whom you vote, because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.